In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening and welcome. We continue with our exploration of one of the five dharmas of Maitreya, Dharma, Dharma, Tava, Bhanga, distinguishing phenomena from their intrinsic nature. And we're in, I think we're on page 40. Does that sound right?
We ended maybe at the top of 39.
Top of 39, just before requirements.
That's the note I had. Next was requirements.
Yeah, that sounds right. And this is part of the 10 topics, right? If you go back a little bit to page 33, we have the unique features on the fundamental transformation, which has 10 aspects. After the summary or listing of those, we have the essence, the substance, individuals, distinct features, and now we have requirements, the fifth topic. On page 39. On the fifth topic, the treatise states, accessing the realization of the requirements refers to distinct past aspirations, the distinct focal point of the revelation of the great vehicle, and the distinct thorough application to the 10 grounds. Three things: past aspirations, a focal point, and the revelation of the great vehicle. I guess four things, and the distinct, thorough application to the 10 grounds. Concerning accessing the realization of the requirements for the fundamental transformation, the fundamental and complete transformation achieved by the bodhisattvas is distinctly superior to that of the listeners, shravakas, and self-realized Buddhas, pratyeka Buddhas, in three ways. This refers to their distinct past aspirations, as they aspire to attain complete enlightenment, the distinct focal point of the sublime words of the revelation of the great vehicle, and the distinct thorough application to cultivating the remedies of the obscurations in order to reach the 10 grounds. Accessing the realization or understanding of those factors that are requirements or prerequisites to this extraordinary, fundamental, and complete transformation refers to the following. First are the distinct aspirations that one makes with the wish to attain great, unsurpassed enlightenment. Such past aspirations include the 10 great aspirations of the bodhisattvas. Oh, I didn't get the list of the 10 great aspirations. Next is the distinction of eliminating superimpositions concerning the topic of the two truths. Superimpositions are conceptual projections of about the way things are that assumes that things have more than they really do have. Meaning in general that they have some sort of essence or nature or existential or ontological status, which comes about by focusing on the entire range of the Buddha's profound and vast sublime words. So that's a tall order, right? Next is the distinction of eliminating superimpositions concerning the topic of the two truths, which comes about by focusing on the entire range of the Buddha's teachings. That's a lot. Profound and vast sublime words, which reveal the path and fruition of the great vehicle. Third is the distinct application as one proceeds through the 10 grounds in order to bring the process of abandonment and realization to a point of culmination. It must be understood that these three distinctions are the causes of this final fundamental transformation, which is superior to that of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. These are its distinct requirements. So the causes, in the sense of requirements, in the sense of causes for the transformation, which is otherwise known as enlightenment. The basis for the transformation. The discussion of the support contains both a summary and detailed explanation. On page 40, concerning the first, the treatise states, accessing the basis or support involves a sixfold access to non-conceptual wakefulness, because one accesses the focal point, the relinquishment of marks, authentic application, characteristics, benefits, and complete understanding. So many lists in this book. Many of them new. That's quite exciting to me. I don't know about you guys. When you come upon new lists. Accessing the basis or support of this fundamental transformation involves a sixfold access to non-conceptual wakefulness. Because one access is one, the focal point of that wakefulness, the relinquishment of marks involved in cultivating that wakefulness, the authentic application involved in that, the characteristics, the benefits, and the complete understanding or fruition. To access the basis, support, or foundation of this final, complete, and fundamental transformation is to enter into non-conceptual wakefulness. Why? Because to attain this fundamental transformation, one must actualize suchness, the primordial purity, that is the way things truly are, and access the nature of this suchness. This is where it gets a little sketchy for me. It's like, how do you actualize suchness?
Well, maybe by what's the other word? Accessing the nature of it. But I'm curious about, actually, just in terms of the language in this book, I think the use of the word access is probably, I don't think I've ever seen the word access used so much. And I'm just curious if you have noticed that it's all about, they use that so extensively. I'm kind of curious what other words are used to mean that, whatever it is they mean.
Yeah, that's a good question. It is used over and over again. If you just flip the pages, it's like everywhere.
Yes.
So let's,
I've been noticing this for weeks now.
Let's take a look at, we did look at a different translation of the root verses by Carl. And let's see. Prose version. Okay, so we should be able to find, this is within the 10 topics, this is topic 5 or something. So let's see.
This one that I have has no headers, so I don't think it.
Okay, realization of fundamental change through 10 points, nature. So if you look back briefly to page 34, instead of nature, the Padmakara Translation Committee has essence. And Carl says that's for realizing the nature. So maybe realizing is what is being translated as accessing. The second one, entity or substance in the Padmakara translation, accessing substantial entities on page 35. Carl says the realization of the entity. So it
Thank you.
looks like
That's that was thank you.
realizing.
I was figuring that there was some other standard word that we were familiar with, and I just was trying to I hadn't quite figured out which one it would be, so that makes it pretty clear. Thank you. That helps. It's curious just how people make these choices, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think, maybe. So let's see. We're in the basis and the fourfold objects, realization of the fourfold objects by virtue of the Mahayana teaching, aspiring for it, slightly different order, being certain about it, and the completion of the accumulations. And we saw that. Okay, good. Access. So we have accessing the basis or support involves a sixfold access. 4 points.
So the other thing I guess we could look at there is what words does he use for the actualized suchness part that you were actually asking about?
Well, that's in Meepom's commentary. Yeah, I was just looking and
Oh,
realizing that that's in
right. I guess
Meepom's
there would be no direct
commentary.
equivalent.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Right, yeah.
But his translation of the basis doesn't have the root verse that they have, accessing the basis on 40, where support involves a sixfold access to non-conceptual wakefulness. And the first one of those is the focal point, which has four types. Different, doesn't it? I don't see his sixfold. That's quite different. Interesting. Well, let's stick with what we have here in the book. So again, on bottom of page 40, because to attain this fundamental transformation, which one must actualize suchness, the primordial purity that is the way things truly are, and access the nature of this suchness. This, in turn, is brought about by the non-conceptual wakefulness that realizes suchness as it is. Without such wakefulness, such a fundamental transformation will never be attained. It is therefore the support of this fundamental transformation on non-conceptual wakefulness. What is non-conceptual wakefulness? There are 6 points that enable one to come to a full and unmistaken understanding of this principle, accessing one, accessing the focal points that allow one to generate this wakefulness, relinquishment of the characteristics that conflict with it. Three, the authentic application to the process that arouses this wakefulness in one's mind stream. Four, the characteristics of the functioning or experiential domain of this wakefulness. Five, the benefits derived from it. And six, a complete understanding of the very essence of wakefulness. We did have got these six parts in the basis. And interesting. Their outline is different. I noticed this early, before the class. I did a bunch of outlines of the different versions and sort of came up with the one that I shared with you, which looks like this. So we're in the fundamental transformation. We're in part six, the basis, which has these two sets of four. In Carl's world version, but in this version of the text, we have this presentation of six, a sixfold. This, like on page 40, the root verse says, accessing the basis or support involves a sixfold access, which is the word they're using for realization. Realization of or to non-conceptual wakefulness, because one accesses the focal point, the relinquishment of marks, authentic application characteristics, benefits, and complete understanding. And interesting. So they give Meepom's outline in the back. I know you guys studied this extensively. Love outlines as much as I do.
Actually, what's interesting is that the difference of the all the same words and items are in this list, but in the case of in your outline anyway, what whereas in the text it's sort of a flat list of six, but you have the focal points with four underneath them, which are four of those things, and then the complete understanding obviously has all these other parts to it. But essentially, yeah. It's the same six elements.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at page 74.
Thank you.
So page 74 is a detail on this section called the basis or support.
Oh yes, these wonderful things with the. I love these things.
So this is part six of the page before is the fundamental transformation, the 10 topics, right? And it has the four focal points that allow one to generate this wakefulness, and the relinquishments. So in my outline, relinquishments is one of the four, and in this version, it's flat. The authentic application, characteristics, benefits, and then complete understanding. And that's how they get six.
Right, that's what I was just saying. It's the
Yeah.
difference of just what's indented, so to speak, and what, whereas in the text it's all flat. It's funny.
It is weird. Okay, well, let's see what the meaning is as opposed to the structure of it. We have the six in this version, and second is an exp so on page 41, second is an explanation of the six topics outlined in the preceding summary. The focal points is the first. The treatise states first accessing, which we now know is realizing, the focal point should be understood to involve four points. The teacher of the great vehicle, interest in and certainty about it, and completion of the accumulations, where interest in and certainty about it seem to be different items, different points. First, accessing the focal point of non-conceptual wakefulness should be understood to involve four points: devotion to one's spiritual friend, the teacher of the great vehicle, interest in the great vehicle, certainty about it, and completion of the accumulations. For the sake of enlightenment, if anyone of these is missing, non-conceptual wakefulness will not come about, will not arise. So, devotion to the teacher, interest in the great vehicle, certainty about it, and completion of the accumulations. Accessing the focal points can be understood to be a fourfold process. To develop non-conceptual wakefulness, one must focus on the vast and profound scriptures that teach the great vehicle. One must also listen to and develop supreme conviction in the unmistakable practical instructions by serving as spiritual guide of the great vehicle. Furthermore, one must develop certainty free from doubts in the meaning of these instructions by relying on the four forms of reasoning, which they don't really talk about. Let's see. So I'll come back to that. By relying on the four forms of reasoning and completely perfect the accumulations by directing the mind in accord with the definite meaning. Since non-conceptual wakefulness will not arise in the correct manner if even one of these four focal points, sorry, one of these focal points is absent, one is advised to practice in this manner. You need all four of these focal points.
Are those reasonings the Madhyamaka reasonings?
Yeah, so it's unclear. So in my mind, there could be three different sets of four. One could be the four reasonings for emptiness in the Madhyamaka tradition. Anybody remember what any of those are? Why are things empty?
Are we talking about the different reasonings, logics, like cause and effect and
Yeah.
nature and
Yeah.
interdependence and things like that, or the one and many?
Yeah, bingo. Right, so the Vajra slippers or slivers is the first one. Cause and effect never meet. Results can't come out of nothing. You can't have something arise from nothing. So if the result wasn't there before, how could it possibly come about? And the third one is phenomena are neither one nor many. And the emphasis on that is that phenomena are not one. They're broken down into multiple parts. All phenomena are compounded. And the fourth one is interdependence. All phenomena are interdependently produced, originated. And then it could be the reasonings in when you go through the discoveries, the six discoveries in Vipassana, and the sixth one is reasoning, and it's nature, function, dependency, and then syllogism, the use of syllogism. could also be the four ways of valid knowing, one of which is direct cognition, or otherwise known as fact, reasoning from fact. The second one is inferential cognition, reasoning from logic. And the third one is from scripture, sacred writings, the Buddhists, this text has it. And the fourth one is from the report of a reliable person, such as the Buddha saying, this is the way it is. So it's a little unclear. So by meaning of these instructions, by relying on the four forms of reasoning, I would sort of vote for the nature, function, dependency, and syllogism, but I'm not sure.
So that means wakefulness will not arise if we don't get this worked out.
Damn, we got to get this worked out. Oh my God, the pressure is on.
We got no access without this, huh?
Yeah,
Missing the
well,
key.
we can see if we can find it in Vasubandhu's commentary real quickly, which is in our source book, right? So let's see. Okay, what constitutes phenomena? I'm sorry, so the beginning of the text. Phenomena through 6 points. Then we have intrinsic nature. Comprehension of the nature of phenomena through 6 points is defining characteristic nature, recollection, arrival. And then the third section of the text is the fundamental change. Okay. Comprehension of the fundamental change through 10 points is unsurpassable through nature, entity, persons. So we're in just before prereq. Let's see, we're in focal points. Let's see. Basis, requirements, prerequisites, foundation is basis, and then we're in mental engagement is the focal points, I guess. Although we're in a subdivision of the foundation, so let's see.
Or is requirements the same as prerequisites?
Yeah. Okay, it's a focal point to four objects.
Oh, there you go. It's being certain about it and the completion of the accumulations. So there you are.
He doesn't seem to say anything. Oh, the relinquishment of character, relinquishing the characteristics of.
Derek,
Yeah.
I looked in this book.
Oh, the Jim Scott. What does he say? Thank you.
I think this is the footnote. It says the four types of logic. This is
Yeah.
from the focal requirement, right? We're under the focal
Yeah.
requirement.
All
He
right,
says
Mary Beth.
the logic of general relations, of specific relations, of valid cognition and the logic of nature. And he gives the Tibetan, which I'm not going to try to.
Yeah, so general relations are generally characterized phenomena, and then specific relations are specifically characterized phenomena. And what was the third one?
I think valid cognition.
Valid cognition and logic of nature.
Interesting.
Four types of logic.
Oh, I see. So those are so generally characterized phenomena is inference, specifically is fact or direct cognition, and then pramana, valid cognition. That seems to be the same as specific characteristics. Yeah, that's interesting. Does he say anything
else? But then logic of nature seems like it's coming from the Madhyamaka reasoning, doesn't it? Or is that something different?
Well, one of the schemes I went through was nature, function, and dependency. And then
syllogism.
Nature, function, dependency, syllogism.
It's funny. So this seems like it sort of matches partly to both of the last two that you described, but not exactly to either one.
Yeah. Anything else, Mary Beth?
Just that.
Nope. Okay. Just that. Well, it's going to be hard to accomplish this.
Well, it might mean that we have to learn all of these.
All of the schemes, all of the possible schemes. That's right.
Because we don't know which one it is, so we have to learn them all.
That sounds like it's time for a spreadsheet.
Yep.
The Bodhisattva spreadsheet.
Yep.
Okay, so let's see. We're on the top of 42. By relying on the four forms of reasoning and completely perfect the accumulations by directing the mind in accord with the definite meaning. In accord with the definite meaning, so as opposed to the provisional. Since non-conceptual wakefulness will not arise in the correct manner if even one of these focal points is absent, one is advised to practice in the means described here manner. So the relinquishment of marks on the second topic, the treatise states, second, accessing the relinquishment of marks involves four points as well. One relinquishes the marks of the discordant, the marks of things that are not the same, the marks of remedies, of suchness, and of realization. This brings about in progression the complete relinquishment of marks that are coarse, intermediate, subtle, and connected for an extended duration. So marks that are coarse is described as marks of the discordant. Intermediate is remedies. Subtle is suchness. And realization is for an extended duration, I guess. Let's see, Kenpo Shenga's commentary using Vasubandhu. Second, accessing the relinquishment of marks involves four points as well. One relinquishes the marks of the discordant factors, such as desire. We relinquish anything that's the opposite of the of non-conceptual wakefulness. The marks of remedies, like repulsiveness. So giving up even the antidote, the effort involved in contemplating suchness, just rest, and the marks of realization brought about by training on the grounds. This brings about in progression the complete relinquishment of marks that are coarse because they cause negative tendencies and are easy to realize. Talking about, I think, desire, intermediate because they remedy negative tendencies such as revulsion or repulsiveness. Three, subtle because they are the remedy for everything else, suchness. And four, connected to the mind stream for an extended duration because they result from training. I guess that's trying to say something like the realization is stable. Second, so the second topic, so meepom, accessing the relinquishment of the marks of the conceited mind, also involves four factors: abandoning the mark of fixating on discordant factors such as desire, abandoning the mark of fixating on repulsiveness and other remedies that eliminate these discordant factors. Three, abandoning the mark of fixating on the focal point of suchness. And four, abandoning the mark of fixating on the qualities of realization. Abandoning. So abandoning all these all these factors that generally are held to be supportive of enlightenment ultimately must be abandoned, I guess.
Where it's like the thing where you cross the river and then you have to leave the canoe behind.
I was thinking
right?
the same thing, yeah. So the marks of fixating on the qualities of realization, such as the 10 strengths, which is a basic categorization of the what's accomplished in Buddhahood, the subject that realizes, or the authentic view that results from treading the path. These are all concepts that conflict with wakefulness. Relinquishing them brings about the attainment of wakefulness in its purest form. As taught in the sutra that teaches the Dharani of non-conceptuality, which is what we read towards the beginning of the course. There's a short little sutra that came from Carl's book. Relinquishing the four marks outlined above brings about a concurrent relinquishment of those marks that are coarse, intermediate, and subtle, up to those marks that remain associated with one's mind stream for a long time and which are difficult to discard, which I think is a reference to the path of familiarization and the sort of remedies that we use on that path for a very long time to progress on the 10 bhumis. Because afflictive phenomena like attachment, which cause negative tendencies, are easy to understand and abandon, the coarse marks of fixating on these discordant factors is relinquished first. The next relinquishment concerns the intermediate marks that ensue from seeing their remedies, such as repulsiveness, as something positive. Suchness is the unsurpassed remedy for all that needs to be eliminated, and also the most sublime factor that is to be realized. For these reasons, relinquishing the subtle concepts of fixating on suchness and clinging to it as a mark is very difficult. Hence, it is relinquished after the preceding factors. The mark of fixating on realization itself is relinquished after all others, since the subtle aspiration that involves desiring to attain a higher level of realization is not surrendered in the context of the grounds and paths. Association with these marks persists for a long time, until non-conceptual wakefulness has completely matured. It remains linked with the mind stream in the form of subtle thinking. The authentic application, which is the third topic, under the six topics for the basis is, let's see, accessing or realizing authentic application, bottom of 43, likewise contains 4 points: application with a focal point, application without a focal point, application without focusing on a focal point, and the application of focusing on the absence of a focal point. Accessing authentic application likewise contains 4 points: application with mere awareness as one's focal point, application without taking an object as one's focal point, application without focusing on a focal point, because awareness itself is not feasible in the absence of an object of awareness, and for the application of focusing on non-duality, the absence of the focal point of duality. Authentic application also involves 4 points. In the first application, one observes that all phenomena are nothing more than mind. Based on that, one's application is such that the apprehended is not observed. This then leads to an application in which neither apprehended nor apprehender are observed. Based upon that, one's subsequent application involves the observation of suchness without observing any apprehended or apprehender at all, and this approach enables one to generate non-conceptual wakefulness. Does this remind, this fourfold scheme remind you of anything?
Like the...
Regard all dharmas as dreams.
Right. There's no appearance.
And then analyze the nature of unborn insight. So first, there's no objects. That all phenomena are nothing more than mind. So regard all dharmas as dreams, or what is it? Appearances are only mind in the Mahamudra system. Appearances are mind. Mind is empty. Based on that, one's application is such that the apprehended is not observed. So that's the first. This leads to an application in which neither apprehended nor apprehender are observed. So there is no mind. There's no observer. And then one's subsequent application involves the observation of suchness. So let go of even the antidote, or what is it?
Or what is it? Spontaneous presence.
Yeah, all appearances are mind. Mind is empty. Mind is mind is empty. Emptiness is spontaneously present. Is the third Mahamudra pointing out, and then spontaneous presence is self-liberated. So, this one doesn't have the fourth one.
Not an exact match.
It splits the first two, yeah. Yeah, but it's quite similar. So we've seen this scheme. This is the basic scheme, basically for Vipassana practice in many situations, traditions. So it's really neat to see it in this text. In this way, while it's easy to realize that external objects are devoid of nature, no problem, no brainer. The non-observation of the mind that apprehends them is more difficult. The same can be said of the remaining steps in the progression are more difficult. Thus, these are produced in the mind stream in a step-by-step manner, in a similar manner to the account of heat being the meditative absorption of the attainment of appearance and so forth in terms of the stages on the path of joining. So the Mipham is referring to the four stages of the path of joining: heat, peak, patience, and supreme worldly dharma. Characteristics on the fourth topic.
Just one note. I just wanted to mention that here again, we have the flip of the Mahamudra view, where they're, you know, they view that seeing external objects as empty is easier than mind, whereas the Mahamudra flips that around and sees it as easier to work with the mind first, right?
Certainly, they prefer that order. They flip that order around, yeah, in the Mahamudra tradition, starting with the observer.
And I think we've seen this before. That, you know,
yeah, Tashi Namgyel says that. But the easier part, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I think in Trungpa Rinpoche's books and things, he does actually use that terminology. I don't know if exactly that word, but they feel like they recommend that first. I thought it's sometimes they said that it is actually in some ways easier because it's direct experience rather than inference.
Agreed. Characteristics. On the fourth topic, the treatise states accessing the characteristics must be understood in terms of 3 points. In terms of abidance in the intrinsic nature, there is no duality, but abidance within the inexpressible intrinsic nature. In terms of the absence of appearance, there is no appearance of the two, probably apprehender and apprehended, of that which is expressed, of the faculties, of objects, of awareness, and of the world, of the environment. As this is the case, this is declared not conceivable, not demonstrable, not present, not appearance, not awareness, and not an abode. This is how the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness are presented in the sutras. In terms of appearance, all phenomena appear equal to the center of space. All that is conditioned appears like illusions, and so on. It's interesting to see how they unpack this. Accessing the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness must be understood in terms of 3 points. In terms of abidance in the intrinsic nature, there is no duality of apprehender and apprehended, but abidance within the inexpressible intrinsic nature. 2, in terms of the absence of appearance, there is no appearance of the two, apprehended and apprehender, of that which is expressed by the mind, of the faculties, of objects, of awareness, and of the world, of the environment. At this point, one may ask, well, what is this meant to demonstrate? Is this the case? This is declared to be not conceivable as the dual entities of apprehended and apprehender, not demonstrable through expressions, not present in the form, faculties of the eye, and so forth, not form or another such appearance, not awareness, since this is not an awareness of anything, and not an abode. Since there is no appearance of the entities of the environment, this is how the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness are presented in the sutras. In terms of appearance, the demonstration of the characteristics of wakefulness, all phenomena appear equal to the center of space because all marks of their respective subjects have been relinquished. Therefore, all that is conditioned appears as unreal, like illusions, mirages, dreams, and so on. Accessing the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness can be understood in terms of 3 points. The characteristic of abiding in the essence of the intrinsic nature. The characteristic of settling into non-conceptual wakefulness where there are no appearances. The characteristic of settling into non-conceptual wakefulness where there are appearances. So to read the first part of that again, accessing the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness can be understood in terms of 3 points. Skipping to the next paragraph, concerning the first of these, when abiding in suchness, the intrinsic nature of all phenomena, the duality of apprehender and apprehended, or ultimately the conceptual division between the two truths is absent. Fully abiding in the intrinsic nature is also ineffable insofar as it cannot be expressed verbally through limited concepts or marks. This reaches a point of culmination in the wakefulness of the Buddhas, in which the two truths are realized to be inseparable and of one taste. This wakefulness sees the intrinsic nature as it is, whereas an approximation is seen on the path of training. So we're located at the path of no more learning. This is the experience of a Buddha, looking back would be the path of training, familiarity, meditation. The second point concerns the attainment of non-conceptual wakefulness where appearances are absent. So he's explaining the three points given in the first paragraph of the page. This includes the dualistic appearance of apprehender and apprehended associated with the non-conceptual sense consciousnesses. The expressions that correspond with these dualistic appearances, which are formulated by the conceptual mind that fixates on them, this is an internal expression, or said differently, the mind's conceptualization of apprehended and apprehender. The eyes and other internal sense faculties, form and other external objects, the eye consciousness and other forms of awareness, and the commonly experienced world of the environment. So the second point concerns the attainment of non-conceptual wakefulness where appearances are absent, so appearances of any type. Let's see. So since all of these have completely subsided and are entirely absent, there are no differentiations whatsoever in suchness, which appears to be of one taste. This is referred to as the subsiding of dualistic appearances into emptiness. So that was the second of three ways of accessing non-conceptual wakefulness, or realizing non-conceptual wakefulness. Therefore, the aforementioned six topics refer respectively to the absence of conception related to visual and other sense consciousnesses, the absence of verbal description, the absence of basis or support for the arising of consciousness, the absence of the appearance of objects, the absence of subjective awareness, and the absence of a place, meaning an environment that serves as a commonly experienced support. These principles demonstrate the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness and are taught in accordance with the presentation given by the Tathagata in the sutras. The sutra, the prophecy requested by Kashyapa from the Ratnakuta states, Kashyapa, permanence is one extreme and impermanence is a second. The middle that lies between these two extremes is the absence of analysis, the absence of description, the absence of support, the absence of appearance, the absence of awareness, and the absence of place. So the Buddha just did this list of the six topics which make up the second point of non-conceptual wakefulness. Something like that. But anyway, it's neat to see that Meepom at least is seeing that this is an expansion of a sutra presentation. The middle that lies between the two extremes is the absence of analysis, the absence of description, which is, so this is repeating the sixfold list that's higher up on this same page. The absence of support, the absence of appearance, the absence of awareness, and the absence of place. Kashyapa, this middle way is referred to as the genuine individual discernment of phenomena. So here we have that term, individual discernment, right? The individual analysis of prajna we had recently in Tashi Namgyal, I think, right? Last night. So this type of prajna, genuine individual discernment of phenomena, discernment of phenomena individually. This phrase comes up over and over again. That's why I keep repeating it right now. And it's not quite clear. What does this mean? Individual discernment of phenomena. Let's see if Meepom explains it. This teaching also applies to self and no self, cyclic existence and the transcendence of suffering. So these two sets of opposites, existence and non-existence, and so on. The middle way that lies between these polarities is, as was taught above, devoid of analysis. Hence, wakefulness devoid of appearances is beyond the nature of appearances. Naturally luminous and equal to space, this is referred to as non-conceptual wakefulness devoid of appearance. In essence, this wakefulness transcends consciousness and cannot be categorized as being conditioned or conditioned or as any other factor. For these reasons, the essence of this wakefulness is not restricted to any such appearance. Indeed, it is naturally luminous and inseparable from the intrinsic nature. So the intrinsic nature is naturally luminous. This is a little bit complicated, this one. This point is sort of all over the place, right? Here we need a spreadsheet, I think, to sort of map this one out. So we're in the fourth topic, characteristics, if you flip back a page, which is sort of this long laundry list. And Kenpo Shenga and Meepom have sorted this laundry list into 3 points first. And then 6 points. So at the bottom of page 46, Meepom says, therefore the aforementioned 6 topics refer respectively to. So where were the 6 topics? It seems like the 6 topics are... Maybe they're in the description of the basis on page 40, extending to 41. I don't see another set of 6 topics. Does anyone else?
Or are we just talking about the 6 within this context of this particular section only?
But where in this section did anyone mention 6?
I'm not sure where they first introduced the numbering, but hold on, trying to recheck.
It could be in the prior paragraph. The second point concerns the attainment of non-conceptual wakefulness where appearances are absent. This includes, 1, the dualistic appearance of apprehend and apprehender associated with non-conceptual sense consciousness. 2, the expressions that correspond with these dualistic appearances, which are formulated by the conceptual mind that fixates on them.
That would be verbal description, okay.
Right. 3, the eyes and other internal sense faculties.
Which is the basis or for the arising of consciousness.
Right. And then form and other external objects is
the appearance of objects.
And then the eye consciousness and other forms of awareness is the absence
subjective awareness.
Subjective awareness. And the commonly experienced world of the environment is the absence of a place. Since all of these have completely subsided entirely, absent, there are no differentiations whatsoever in suchness which appears to be of one taste. And this is referred to as the subsiding of dualistic appearances into emptiness. It sounds like they're asserting that they've summed up all appearances in those 6 categories. Therefore, the aforementioned 6 topics refer respectively to the absence of conception related to visual and other sense. So then he repeats that 6-fold list. And then the Buddha references it. Permanence is one extreme, impermanence the second. The middle that lies between these two extremes is, one, the absence of analysis. Which was described above in the numbered version as the absence of conception related to sense experience. Two, the absence of description is the absence of verbal description. Three is the absence of support, absence of basis or support for the arising of consciousness. Four, the absence of appearance, the absence of awareness. And the absence of a place are basically identical to the list above. Kashyapa, this middle way is referred to as the genuine individual discernment of phenomena.
That's where I have we were. Just one question that's not related to the numeration of six, but in the Kashyapa top line, permanence is one extreme and impermanence is a second. So that sort of just jumped out at me as we were rereading it earlier, that thinking of impermanence is often viewed as a right view, but here it's being regarded as an extreme view.
Permanence is one extreme and impermanence is a second extreme. Yeah, well, to say that all phenomena are impermanent is the extreme of saying that there are phenomena, I guess. or rather the opposite, the extreme of saying that there are no phenomena because they're all impermanent. Whereas the extreme of permanence is saying that there are phenomena that persist.
So you think this is just existence and non-existence in different words? Or not.
I think it's like eternalism and nihilism. So taking impermanence. Similar, right?
Yeah, I think that's what I meant. Yeah, it's just funny because even though I mean, maybe it's just I never put those together, but somehow impermanence usually is viewed as a kind of a more correct understanding, but it's just I never thought of it as being the polarity of in that way.
Yeah, you'll have to talk to the Buddha about that.
Okay, yeah. At my next opportunity.
Or maybe Kashyapa, because he was talking with Kashyapa. Kashyapa probably has a good idea of it.
Right, thank you.
This teaching also applies to self and no self, so saying that there is no self is one extreme. And so you see this like in the Buddha nature teachings, where it turns out that there is a self, there is purity, there is permanence, there is, what's the fourth quality? Bliss or something. Let's see. This teaching also applies to self, no self, cyclic existence, samsara and transcendence, nirvana existence, non-existence, so on. The middle way that lies between these polarities is, as was taught above, devoid of analysis. Hence wakefulness, devoid of appearances, is beyond the nature of appearances. Naturally luminous and equal to space, this is referred to as non-conceptual wakefulness, devoid of appearance. In essence, this wakefulness transcends consciousness and cannot be categorized as being conditioned, unconditioned, or as any other factor. For these reasons, so non-conceptual wakefulness is beyond characterization. For these reasons, the essence of this wakefulness is not restricted to any such appearance. Indeed, it is naturally luminous and inseparable from the intrinsic nature. So the intrinsic nature of all phenomena is naturally luminous, non-conceptual wakefulness. In relation to the wakefulness that realizes the way things are, we may also want to distinguish the wakefulness that realizes things in their multiplicity, which sees all appearances as equally yet distinct. while never wavering from this basic state. Without any conflict between them, these two forms of wakefulness combine as a unity. So these are the two types of omniscience, knowing the nature of things and knowing their manifestation. Their manifold variety of manifestation. How is this so? Within the state of suchness, the intrinsic nature, all phenomena are of one taste. Nevertheless, without any wavering from this state, all subjects simply appear. Hence, there is no contradiction between these two, because while appearances do manifest unceasingly to the self-appearance of the wakefulness that beholds the intrinsic nature, there is no fixation on them as this and that. From this perspective, the absence of appearances taught above is perfectly complete, since here one is moved beyond the nature of ordinary dualistic experience and other such factors. This incredibly important and profound topic has been discussed here as a supplementary explanation. Well, that was helpful. Saying that it's important and profound, meaning difficult, and that it's a supplementary explanation to what we had read before that. So third, this characterization of the next subject as being third, I think, refers back to the threefold list on page 46, which is the characteristic of abiding in the essence and the intrinsic nature, the characteristic of settling into non-conceptual wakefulness with no appearances, and three, the characteristic of settling into non-conceptual wakefulness where there are appearances. So third, in terms of appearance, on page 48, during the meditative equipoise, all phenomena are of one taste and remain undifferentiable in terms of their essential suchness. In other words, they appear as equality, which can be likened to the center of space. The wakefulness that is attained subsequent to this equipoise, on the other hand, may perceive the entire range of conditioned phenomena, which appear like illusions, optical illusions, dreams, and other such appearances that lack any nature of their own. On the ground of Buddhahood, this process culminates in a realization within which there is no equipoise or subsequent attainment as distinct from each other. Right, so we've talked about this before, where initially on the path of seeing, one experiences in meditative equipoise the true nature of phenomena, the true nature of reality. And then after arising from that meditative equipoise, one experiences a subtle sense of duality, subtle in the sense that we're no longer sort of believing in duality, but it continues to appear due to the latent tendencies accumulated since beginningless time. And so that's what happens on the path of familiarization, or here called training, otherwise known as meditation. The fourth path is that we try to bring together equipoise and post-meditation experience, here called subsequent attainment. An approximation of this realization occurs on the grounds of the Noble Ones, whereas on the path of mantra, something that resembles it already arises in the mind stream with the occurrence of the symbolic wakefulness due to the profound skillful means of this path. So, this is a little indication that on the path of mantra, this advanced experience occurs earlier on than in the sutra tradition. In the sutra tradition, this occurs, the author says, as on the grounds of the Noble Ones, which would probably be at least the first Bhumin above, but probably more like the eighth Bhumin above. And in the path of mantra, it already arises in the mind stream with the occurrence of the symbolic wakefulness due to the profound skillful means of this path. So the wakefulness of symbol or symbolic. That has a specific meaning in Tantra, symbolic wakefulness. I'm not quite remembering what it is. In this way, it must be understood that while the perfected way that a Buddha sees things involves two forms of wakefulness, the wakefulness that sees things as they are, and the wakefulness that sees things in their multiplicity. And while the meditative equipoise of the path of training may or may not involve appearance, there is no contradiction in either of these cases. This is a vital point to comprehend. Hence, due to the importance of this topic, I have offered this explanation, along with a bit of supplementary discussion. So that's me, Palm, talking. Sort of explaining why he gave a rather extended presentation of that verse. The benefits. On the fifth topic, the benefits, the treatise states, accessing the benefits involves 4 points. The attainment of the perfection of the body of qualities, the attainment of unexcelled bliss, the attainment of the mastery of wisdom, and the attainment of the mastery of teaching. Accessing the benefits involves 4 points. 1, the attainment of the fundamental transformation through the perfection of the body of qualities. The body of qualities. So, body, speech, mind, quality, and action. When we look at the 5 types of forms of the Nirmanakaya, we say that there's the body manifestation, the speech manifestation, the mind manifestation, the activity manifestation, body, speech, mind, body, speech, mind, qualities, and action, activity. Anyway, let's see. So we're on the fifth topic. The treatise states, accessing the benefits involves 4 points. The attainment and the perfection of the body of qualities. The attainment of unexcelled bliss. The attainment of the mastery of vision, presumably meaning wisdom. And the attainment of the mastery of teaching. Accessing the benefits involves 4 points. The attainment of the fundamental transformation through the perfections of the body of qualities. The attainment of the supreme unexcelled bliss through which defiling bliss is relinquished. 3, the attainment of the mastery of vision through which the objects of knowledge are realized as they are and in their multiplicity. Those 2 ways of realizing the nature of phenomena. And 4, the attainment of the mastery of teachings, which brings about numerous pathways that are taught in a fitting manner. The attainment of the mastery of teaching. So those 4 benefits. 5th, so in this 5th topic, this is Meepom's commentary. Accessing the benefits of non-conceptual wakefulness involves 4 points. Non-conceptual wakefulness itself brings about the attainment of the complete body of qualities, the culmination of the fundamental transformation in which one is divested of the 2 obscurations, which happens at Buddhahood. Transcending ephemeral, unstable, and defiling bliss, along with its associated habitual tendencies, one gains unexcelled great bliss, which is essentially immutable and non-defiling, not defiling. One attains mastery over pure and spontaneously present. Wait a second. Sorry, okay, so one attains mastery over pure and spontaneously present vision, which beholds all objects of cognition as they are and in their multiplicity in an unerring manner. Finally, One also attains mastery over the ability to teach the limitless beings in need of guidance without any effort. One is able to teach them the various gateways to the Dharma, the principles of the profound and the vast, in a way that matches their individual interests. From this perspective, we can see that the cause of bringing about the culmination of the process of abandonment realization is non-conceptual wakefulness itself, which is why these four benefits of wakefulness have been outlined here. In this fifth topic, the benefits, there are 4 points, right?
You're muted?
Have I been muted for a long time?
No, just...
Good. Okay, so that was a little mysterious, that fifth topic. Complete understanding. On the sixth topic, the treatise states, accessing complete understanding should be understood to be fourfold. Complete understanding of the remedy, the antidotes, complete understanding of the characteristics, complete understanding of the distinctions, and complete understanding of the five functions. Accessing complete understanding should be understood to be fourfold. Complete understanding of the remedy for the five discordant factors. Complete understanding of the characteristics of freedom from the five types of non-conceptuality. Freedom from non-conceptuality. Three, complete understanding of the five superior distinctions. And four, complete understanding of the five functions of wakefulness. So four sets of five. Sixth, accessing the complete understanding of the principle of wakefulness contains, one, a summary and a detailed explanation. Concerning the first, accessing complete understanding can be understood to be fourfold. Complete understanding of the way in which wakefulness serves as a remedy for discordant factors. Two, complete understanding of the characteristics by divesting oneself of the five forms of non-conceptuality that can lead one astray. Three, complete understanding of the five qualities that set it apart from inferior paths. And four, complete understanding of the five functions of wakefulness. So that was the summary presentation. Second, for the detailed explanation, we shall discuss the aforementioned four topics, the first of which is remedies. It's a little bit of a mind-numbing text, isn't it? Very sort of advanced text. Sort of begs like a really simple commentary. Here, non-conceptual wakefulness should be understood to be the remedy for the apprehension of phenomena and persons. Non-conceptual wakefulness. Four, one, the apprehension of phenomena persons, two, complete change, difference, three, and denigration, four. There are five apprehensions of the non-existent for which it is taught to be the remedy. Here, non-conceptual wakefulness should be fully understood to be the remedy for the apprehension of non-existent phenomena and non-existent persons. I think they... when they're talking about non-existent phenomena, persons, they're talking about all phenomena and all persons. But let's see. For complete change, thirdly, the arising and so forth of that which does not exist. For the perceived difference between non-existent phenomena and their own nature. And lastly, for the denigration of taking phenomena and persons that exist as products of the imagination to be completely non-existent. So, taking phenomena and persons that exist as products of the imagination to be completely non-existent. So, basically, all phenomena exist as imagination, because all phenomena are beyond existence and non-existence, and so their only existence is the way that we conceptualize them. with our imaginative powers. There are five apprehensions of the non-existent for which it is taught to be the remedy, it being non-conceptual wakefulness. First is the knowledge of the remedies for the discordant factors. Since non-conceptual wakefulness is entered into suchness without exaggerating or deprecating or depreciating the way things are, meaning the inseparable two truths, it eliminates all negative views that adhere to extreme positions. Depreciating, that's a way of, that's like a financial term, right? Where you amortize the, anyway, never mind. Depreciating the way things are, meaning the inseparable two truths, it eliminates all negative views that adhere to extreme positions. There are five such extreme positions. One is the belief in form and other phenomena. So the belief in the external counterparts of the sense faculties, form and so forth, sound. The belief in the self of a person, of persons. And these five are apprehensions of the non-existent for which non-conceptual wakefulness is taught to be the remedy. And these are the five that adhere to extreme positions: the belief in form and other phenomena, the belief in the self of persons, the belief in arising and cessation, meaning the complete transformation of things from an earlier state. There is no change. There is no impermanence. Because there's nothing that changes, I guess. The belief that phenomena and their intrinsic nature are separate from one another. Just because they're presented separately in this text doesn't mean they actually are separate. And five, the belief that denigrates phenomena that are mere appearances by holding that they do not even exist at the conventional level. That's negating appearances, that's over-negating, and not accepting that phenomena exist as appearances. And on the conventional level, these five have no bearing on the way things are, and so they lack establishment. They're not established, which is why we like them so much. Nevertheless, the ignorant intellect believes in the two selves, arising and cessation, difference and denigration, since all of these are involved with something that is not the case. They are referred to as belief in the non-existent. Non-conceptual wakefulness is itself taught to be the remedy for the five distorted beliefs in that which does not exist. The entire range of negative views is exemplified by these four distorted views that exaggerate, and one distorted view that denigrates will not occur to those in possession of this non-conceptual wakefulness. So let's look back at that list briefly and see if we can tell the difference between the ones that exaggerate with superimposition and the ones that denigrate. So belief in form is...
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
The very last line, just curious. All these negative views will not occur to those in possession of this non-conceptual wakefulness. So now, if I understand it correctly, on some level, that non-conceptual wakefulness is already there.
Yeah, their language is weird.
And so possession is, you know, it seems like
it's
all their prior words
so long.
Access and realization might be a better term here instead of possession, right?
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Sorry to interrupt there, but no problem. Seemed too huge to...
Yeah. I have a doctor named Dr. Possession. His partner is Dr. Cash. Anyway, let's see. Belief in form, the first one is an exaggeration, right? It's a superimposition. Belief in the self of persons is exaggeration. Belief in arising is exaggeration, belief that phenomena and their intrinsic nature are separate as exaggeration. And then fifth, a belief that denigrates phenomena that are mere appearances by holding they do not even exist at the conventional level is denigration. So next page, the complete knowledge of the characteristics, which is the second topic of this set of four topics that map out complete understanding. So if you remember the outline, there were four focal objects, and then there's four sets of complete understanding, and now we're in the second aspect or type of complete understanding. On the second topic, the treatise states, as for the complete knowledge of all characteristics, there is no directing of the mind. Complete transcendence, thorough pacification, the state of the essence, and apprehension of manifest signs. The specific characteristic is the abandonment of these five. Okay, so as for the complete knowledge of the characteristics, there's no directing of the mind, there's no complete transcendence, there's no thorough pacification, there's no state of the essence, and no apprehension of manifest signs. And the abandonment of these is the specific characteristic. That's interesting. Not quite sure what they mean by this being the specific characteristic. Let's see what the others say. As for the complete knowledge of the characteristics, there is no directing of the mind, as in the case of a small child. So if we don't think there's any real objects, then we don't direct the mind to anything. I guess there's sort of no agency involved. Two, there's complete transcendence of concept and discernment, as in the second concentration, and so forth. So referring to the absorptions, where even concept and discernment have been let go of, which is sort of odd, because that means that in the first absorption, there is conception and discernment, contrary to what we normally believe about the absorptions as being without concept and discernment. The first one has those. Three, thorough pacification of concepts, as is the case when one falls asleep, loses consciousness, and so forth. Four, the state of the non-conceptual essence of the eyes, and so forth. So the type of cognition of the five senses is non-conceptual. It's sort of without recognition. It's just pure registration. And five, the apprehension of manifest signs involved when one entertains the thought, I shall not think. The apprehension of manifest signs. That's weird. The specific characteristic is the abandonment of these five. Okay. Second, complete understanding of the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness. Sorry. The complete understanding of the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness is taught in terms of eliminating the five deviations, which are not in harmony with non-conceptual wakefulness. This is because while non-conceptual wakefulness does not see or grasp any image whatsoever that could serve as a focal point, it nevertheless does see the suchness of all phenomena. So it doesn't identify any phenomena, any focal point, but instead it sees the suchness. Such a mode of cognition is just as unfathomable to an ordinary individual as visual form is to a blind person. So completely foreign to us is this experience of perception without perceiving anything, I guess is one way you could put it. Wakefulness, the next paragraph, cannot be immediately demonstrated in an affirmative manner to those whose perspective is limited in scope. Interesting. That's the implication is that wakefulness is an affirmative, and that can only be introduced to persons who are more advanced, it seems. In essence, it is entirely non-conceptual, that wakefulness, meaning that it unerringly realizes the fact that the intrinsic nature cannot be observed in relation to any extreme position whatsoever. So extreme positions are the two extremes of exaggeration and denigration, or superimposition and deprecation or denigration. With this realization, there's no fixation at all, which is in harmony with the intrinsic nature. So this term fixation, I think, is a very is referring to a sort of subtle conceptual grasping that occurs in the process of apprehension, as in an apprehender apprehending an apprehended, as opposed to me being fixated on this or that, or you. Moreover, at the bottom of 52, this is not non-conceptual in the sense of being non-unconscious. So it's not unconsciousness, this non-conceptuality, like blocking consciousness and so on. In other words, non-conceptual does not refer to simply not engaging the mind with mundane conventional concepts that mix up words and their meanings. Likewise, though there are no such conceptual processes at work in the mind streams of newborn children or calves, for example, such states are not referred to as non-conceptuality. So you wouldn't say that a newborn child has a non-conceptual state just because they haven't learned a lot of concepts, I guess. Though we may say that small children possess the mental capacity to mix words and their meanings, which is how they explain, which is their way of describing conceptuality, this associative apprehension, which is another way of describing conceptuality, is not active from birth, for they do not know how to engage in the process of conceptual discernment. Interesting way of referring to children as not yet being conceptual beings fully in sort of full-blown, I guess. It is the latter state of mind that is taken as the example in the present context. The latter. Who's the latter? Calves? The minds of calves? It's a little unclear who the latter is here. So, it is the latter state of mind that is taken as the example.
Latter is the calves.
It has to be the calves. Yeah, I don't know. That's a little unclear. Wow, what a heavy text. Who knew what we were treading into here with this?
It could just be that prior line where they're saying that while small children possess the ability to mix words and meaning, that the associate is not active from birth, for they do not know how to engage in the process of conceptual discernment. So maybe they're just referring to that last phrase about the not engaging in the process of conceptual discernment.
It might. But it is the latter state of mind.
I mean, in that case, the apostrophe S makes no sense in that case, but that is a possibility. It would be better if that were true, it probably should have said it is the latter state of mind rather than.
I don't know. It's vaguely possible that it goes back to the first paragraph by Meepom on the page before that starts with second complete understanding of the characteristics of non-conceptual wakefulness taught in terms of eliminating the five deviants that are not in harmony with non-conceptual wakefulness. This is because While non-conceptual wakefulness does not see or grasp any image whatsoever that could serve as a focal object, which I think is sort of like children and calves, it nevertheless does see the suchness of phenomena. It might be that. I don't know. It's unclear.
I mean, this is referring to that line about no directing of the mind, right?
It does seem to be. Well, it's not far. It's unclear how far it goes back, though. Right?
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's. I guess we'd have to parse it out further.
Yeah. So you went back to the root verse. As for the complete knowledge of the characteristics, there is no directing of the mind.
I went to the middle one, the Vajrabandhu version, the no directing of the mind, as in the case of a small child, is what was added to the root verse there.
Right. So that would be the former. And then part two, complete transcendence of concept and discernment, as in the second concentration, and so forth, would be the latter?
Actually, no. I'm not sure where they were trying to read. I mean, I thought... That's what it seems like they're connecting there in terms of this child metaphor, this no directing of the mind. But.
Very interesting. Well, let us pause at that point. Let us pause.
We'll figure it out by next week.
Yeah. Well, that was a very effective way of distracting ourselves from whatever else is going on in the world. Who knows what that might be. So when we meet again next week, it'll probably be colder. It'll probably be colder. This unusual warm spell will probably be over. Anyway, thank you very much. Great to see you.
Let's might have rained by next week, maybe.
That would be nice. God, this drought is intense. Let's conclude with our dedication of the limitless merit accumulated here tonight. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. May the right person win. Thank you, everyone. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.